reading passage will be taken from Exodus chapter 20, verses 3 through 6. Chapter 20, verse 3. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for their sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to a thousand generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. May God bless the reading of his word.
Our speaker today is Dr. Andrew Lee, and he was our retreat speaker there at our retreat. He challenged us to consider our bicultural nature as a gift from God. Dr. Lee is, or has been, a pastor, is currently teaching, and leads a parachurch organization called Isaac. He is married, has three children. His wife's name is Penny, and he has a black belt in karate. Let's welcome Dr. Lee this morning.
Everything's true except the black belt, obviously. Good morning again, and it's been several months. It's good to be with you. I remember lots of things about you. I just may not remember your name. So that's the only thing. You may have to remind me of your name, but I'll generally remember our conversations and who you are and things we've done. Little Sarah loved the last 30 minutes of her kindergarten class because at the end of the day, her teacher, Mrs. Hunter, would allow the class to draw. So one day, Sarah's drawing furiously, and the bell rings. It's time for school to be dismissed. But Sarah keeps drawing. And so Mrs. Hunter walks over just to see what's going on. And she says, "Sarah, what are you drawing?" Sarah says, "I'm drawing a picture of God." And Mrs. Hunter, as kindly as she could, says to Sarah, "But Sarah, no one knows what God looks like." And Sarah says, "They will when I get through." Well, can you draw a picture of God? That's what our text this morning is about. A prohibition against drawing a picture of God, of making an idol. And the reason why I chose this text for this morning is because the first time I was here, I spoke on the first commandment. So just to complete that, I thought I'd speak on the second commandment, which goes hand in hand with the first commandment. It is a commandment against idolatry, against the production of idols. And it's easy, of course, for us to wonder, well, why talk about that today? After all, it's not as if you have an idol in front of your church. It's not as if there's an idol mounted here. So why talk about idols? It's a common problem in Moses' day where every temple that you passed had at least one idol in front of it. But why today? Why does this commandment still apply to us? Well, to answer that, the first question is, what is an idol? Let's see, I've got this right page up. And it's not working. Do I have it on? Did it work? Okay, it went in pause mode. What is an idol? Why do people make images at all? And to answer that question, here's a story about a man named Jack. So Jack's walking along a cliff. And his problem is that he's walking too close to the edge of a cliff. And accidentally, his foot slips and he begins to fall. So he frantically grabs for anything he can hold on to, finds his branch, holds on to it for dear life, and calls out for help. "Help! Help! Is anyone there?" And there's no answer. Keeps calling, "Help, is anyone there?" You know, and Jack's losing his strength. He knows he can't hold on forever. And then suddenly he hears this voice. "Jack, can you hear me?" And Jack says, "Yes, I can hear you. I'm down here."
"Yes, I see you, Jack."
"Who are you? Who are you?"
And the voice comes back, "I'm the Lord, Jack.
You mean God?
Yes, Jack.
That's me. Oh, God, please help me out of this mess. I promise if you get me out of this, I'll stop sinning. I'll be a really good person. I'll serve you for the rest of my life.
Easy on the promises, Jack. Let's just get you out of there. Then we'll talk.
Okay, Lord. Just tell me what to do.
Okay, Jack. Let go.
What?
Let go, Jack. Just trust me.
Long pause. And finally, Jack says, is anyone else up there? Well, we can laugh at Jack, but we would rather trust the voice of what we see than trust the voice of an unseen God. Jack's a typical person. We would rather trust what we can see and who we can touch rather than an invisible God. We would rather walk by the faith of a visible God than in an invisible God. And that's why this commandment is given. Look again at verse 4. All right, we're going to do a pause, or let's see. All right, so someone's there. So every time I do this, you're going to click. Okay. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. Okay, so I have three phrases underlined, right? Heaven above, earth beneath, or waters below. Now, if you look at this from the perspective of a pre-scientific man, this is what he sees. He walks out, you know, outside the church building, right? He's outside, and he looks up, and what does he see? He sees the sky above. Then he looks down at what he's standing on, and it's the earth beneath. And then he knows if he walks the edge of the land, right, as far as the land will go, that he might hit water. And so he concludes there is water beneath the earth. So if you, next diagram. This is the three-tiered cosmogony of the world as it was known, as ancient man knew it. And I know there's a lot of detail there, but just look at three things. That there is a sky above, right? Heaven above, there's the earth, and then there are waters below. And so what this commandment means is this. You shall not use anything to represent me out of the entire universe. Nothing that flies in the sky, no bird, no winged creature. Nothing that walks on the earth, whether it walks on four legs or two legs. Nothing that swims in the waters below, whether it is a fish or a crocodile or anything else. You will not use anything to represent me in this entire world because nothing in this universe is capable of representing who I am. That's what this commandment is about. That there is nothing that can take the place of God, and therefore you cannot use anything to represent Him. But did people make idols? They surely did. Look then at Isaiah 44:15. It is man's... He cut down cedars, or perhaps took a cypress or oak. He let it grow among the trees of the forest, or planted a pine, and the rain made it grow. It is man's fuel for burning. Some of it he takes and warms himself. He kindles a fire and he bakes bread. But he also fashions a god and worships it. He makes an idol and bows down to it. Half of the wood he burns in the fire. Over it he prepares his meal. He roasts his meat, eats his fill. From the rest he makes a god, his idol. He bows down to it and worships. He prays to it and says, "Save me. You are my God." Now, Isaiah and also Jeremiah poke fun at the making of idols. And there is a sarcastic tone in this passage. So he's saying, well, how's an idol made? A man goes to a tree, chops it down, cuts it in half, and with half of it, he burns it, roasts his meat with it, cooks his meal over it, and the other half he fashions and designs and creates an idol. Then he bows down to this idol that he has created and says, "Save me, you are my God."
Again, this is the prophet speaking in the most sarcastic tone. And we understand how an idol is made. Even those who worship idols understand how an idol is made, that it is the creation of a human being. So then why the attraction of idolatry? And I think one of the answers to that question is this. It goes back to the Jack story. It is easier to worship a God who you see. And in some ways, when you have an idol, you then begin to build a temple perhaps around it. You begin to design rules for worshiping this idol. And it is much easier to worship a God this way than to trust and worship an invisible God. So if you have perhaps an idol in a temple, you begin to make rules such as no food or drink in the sanctuary, which doesn't apply to your church, by the way, because you eat in here. But in many churches, they won't allow any food in the sanctuary. Other rules would be, well, once a year you have to bring a lamb and you have to sacrifice a lamb. Or before you enter the sanctuary, you need to take off your shoes because this is holy ground. So you devise a whole set of rules regarding the worship of this idol or this god. Speaking of taking off shoes, several summers ago, some professors and I attended a short-term course in which we were going about looking at different religions in New York City, and our particular group went to Flushing, and we had the opportunity to visit different temples. And here's a picture of us, if you can get that on. That's us in the back. So the five of us in the back, we're in the Sikh temple in Flushing. And this was an article run by the New York Times. So a New York Times reporter accompanied us for some of our trips, and this is a picture that actually did appear in the New York Times. And if you click, okay, there should be, there I am. In case you couldn't spot me, there I am. Click again, and you see the wonderful vegetarian food that we're eating, because for the Sikhs, you can't eat meat. So you need to eat vegetarian foods. And one more click. There you see the shoeless fellow. If you look, none of us are wearing shoes. And so these are the rules. You come into the temple, you have to take off your shoes, you have to, you know, put something over your head. And believe me, there is an odor when you enter the temple. The Sikh temple was not the worst. The cleanest was the Muslim temple. The stinkiest was the Hindu temple. But the point is that you begin to devise rules, right? You have all sorts of rules. So let's say you're a Sikh worshiper. You obey the rules. You take your shoes off before you enter. You only eat vegetarian food. You put this turban around your head. And there are other sorts of rules and commands that you follow, seasons that you obey, ceremonies that you obey. And when this is all done, what you end up saying is, look, I'm a good worshiper, because I followed all the rules of my religion. I've done everything my God has asked me to do. Therefore, my God owes me because I am a good person. You see how this begins to work? It's much easier to worship a God with all these rules around them, because when you fulfill them all and you can see this visible reputation of your God, you're a good person. And you then, your God owes you to some extent. And you begin to manipulate the worship of your God. Jewish people may not have made an idol to Yahweh, their God, but you know what they did? They made the temple their God. Look at Prophet Jeremiah, chapter 7. This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. Reform your ways and actions, and I will let you live in this place. Do not trust in deceptive words and say, this is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. If you really change your ways and your actions and deal with each other justly, if you do not oppress the alien, the fatherless, or the widow, and do not shed innocent blood in this place, and if you do not follow other gods to your own harm, then I will let you live in this place, in the land I gave your forefathers forever and ever. But look, you are trusting in deceptive words that are worthless. You see what's going on? The Jewish people said, Jerusalem is where God lives, and the temple is the very house of God. So as long as we follow all these rules for taking care of the temple,
and we follow the temple rituals. We give a sacrifice every day. Every 30 days we bring a different offering. We obey the feast throughout the year. We bring God everything that He tells us to do, and we follow the rules and taking care of the temple. Then we are safe. This is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. No nation will ever conquer us because God is with us and this is His home. And if you understand the Old Testament, this is exactly how the Jewish people felt. They felt that Jerusalem was sacred, that it would never fall because the temple of God was there. And so what do? They go about, as this passage says, they oppress other people. They shed innocent blood. They do all sorts of mischief. And yet they feel that they can go into the temple on Sunday or on Saturday, in their case, or Friday night, and they can do whatever they want because they follow the rules of their religion, and therefore they are good people. And the prophet says, do not trust in these deceptive words, because you also need to live correctly. Do not trust in these deceptive words. Now, how does all this apply to us? We don't have a temple per se, though we have a sanctuary. Take this, you know, don't even talk about this. What we begin doing is thinking this way. Well, I go to church every Sunday. I come here and worship. I read the Bible. And I pray to God. I do my devotions every day, 30 minutes every day, you know, whatever it is. I give my money to the church. I serve in the church. Therefore, God owes me because I'm a good person. And I've done everything that's required of me as a Christian. And we begin thinking then that God owes us. And so when we pray and God doesn't answer our prayers, what do we begin thinking? God, are you really there? How come you didn't answer my prayer? Or when bad things begin happening to us, right? We lose our jobs. We lose that boyfriend or girlfriend. We don't get into college we want. We can't buy what we want. Whatever it is, when unfortunate things begin happening in our lives, many Christians begin saying, God, where are you? Where are you? I'm a good Christian. I've done everything you've asked me to do. I've obeyed these rules, but how come you're not blessing me and answering my prayer? And what happens then is that people begin doubting whether God is really there, whether God is powerful enough to answer their prayers, whether God really loves them. And what that means is we're beginning to manipulate God. We're trying to manipulate God. God, you owe me because I've done everything that you've asked me to do, but why aren't you answering my prayers? And why isn't my life going the way I want it to go? Is that not true? That happens to many Christians. Maybe not to you, but to many believers. This then begins to be idolatry of a different kind. But it is idolatry. In terms of the temple, what did God do in 586 B.C.? He allowed the Babylonians to destroy the temple for the first time. In 70 A.D., he allowed the Romans to destroy the rebuilt temple, and that temple has not been rebuilt in nearly 2,000 years and may never be rebuilt. This is what Augustine says. And I have the quote. Idolatry is worshiping anything that ought to be used or using anything that ought to be worshipped. Idolatry is worshiping anything that ought to be used. What God gives us to use, if we worship that, that's idolatry. But idolatry is also using anything that ought to be worshipped. Using the God whom we're supposed to worship, if we begin trying to manipulate Him, saying, God, I'll do this, but you've got to do this for me. Or, God, I'm doing all these things, you've got to do this for me. That also is idolatry. And the second commandment is a prohibition against any idols, because God is too powerful and too mysterious for that. Second point, second question is, what will idols do to you? So what happens when we worship idols? Psalm 115, two verses, verse 4. But their idols are silver and gold made by the hands of men. And then verse 8, those who make them will be like them, and so will all who trust in them. We become like the idols that we worship. That's what this
these verses saying. If we worship an idol, we're going to be just like that God whom we worship. Mundane example of that. Remember a number of years ago, Michael Jordan made some Hanes commercials. This is when, you know, Mike was still playing and everybody likes to be like Mike. So he's advertising for Hanes commercial. In this particular clip, which you can still find on YouTube, by the way, but it's very poor quality, so that's why I'm not showing it. But you have these group of men in their underwear in the locker room, and they're all wearing white underwear. In comes Michael Jordan with his gym bag, sits down, opens his gym bag, pulls out his underwear, and it's red, right? Chicago Bulls, it's red. And all the guys look down at their white and see that Michael's wearing red. Next scene. Same group of guys in the locker room. Now, guess what color underwear they're wearing? Red. In comes Mike. Pulls out, you know, his pair of shorts in the gym bag, and this is the color. Polka dot. So now all the guys look down at their briefs, and they're thinking, oh no, we're wearing the wrong color. Well, that's a mundane example of this principle that we become like the God whom we worship. Right? We worship Mike because Michael is it. So we emulate Mike. Right? Why else do advertisers use movie stars, singers, athletes to market perfume, food, dieting plans, any number of things? Because we want to be like the God that we worship, the person we idolize. And if we worship a God who permits holy war, will we not then also be militant in ourselves? If we worship a God who says, don't care about the world, it's karma, would we then not withdraw from the world and not care about the sufferings and the ills of those around us? And if we worship a God who says, I gave my life to die on the cross for the world, would we also not then become sacrificial in our lives as well? You see, we become like the God whom we worship. Well, what types of gods do we worship in our society? The unholy trinity, as I call them, would be money, sex, and power. And very quickly, you know, we love money. Here's a picture. Right? More money than God. You like that? We love money. The West is so materialistic. Our society is extremely materialistic. Chinese society from the past was always materialistic. And you look at China today, I've been saying this for more than a decade, money is the new god of China. It's not communism, it's money. If you've been to China, you understand what I mean. Right? Money. Another god, sex. You can buy, you know, market anything with sex. This happens to be a Pepsi, a very sexy drink. But you can market anything. You can market, potato chips using a pretty woman. You can market cars with it. You know, you can even market reading books about the Bible. You could even market that using sex. Remember the book, Bad Girls of the Bible? Well, you know, go read the Bible if you want to read about bad girls. I mean, if you really wanted to twist it that way, you could. We use sex to market everything. Power. Hey, people love power. People wish they were at the new temple, the boardroom, the corporate boardroom, where all sorts of decisions are made. That's power. We become like the God whom we worship. This is what Susie Orman says. And Susie, you may know from her book, The Road to Wealth. But Susie talks about this in one of her books. She's 13 years old. And her father owns this little shack where he fries chicken, cooks hamburgers and hot dogs. So here he is in this little wooden shack. And one day, the oil that he uses to fry the chicken and the French fries becomes so hot that it explodes. And this little wooden shack that he has his business in catches fire. So he rushes out, the firemen are called. So the father is standing outside on the grass in safety, seeing the firemen around him. His shack is burning up. little Susie is there, her mother is there, the whole family's there, and all of a sudden, her father remembers that his money is still in the shack. You know, his cash register is still in the shack. So he runs back into the shack to rescue his cash register. He tries to open it, but by this time it's become so hot that the metal cash register has become warped, and he can't open it. So what does he do? He picks up the cash register and hugs it to his chest, the scalding hot metal, runs out of the shack, throws it to the ground. And when he throws it to the ground, the skin of his arms and his chest come off. And this is what Susie says. That was when I learned that money is obviously more important than life itself. From that point on, earning money, lots of money, not only became what drove me professionally, but also became my emotional priority. Right? From that point on, from learning from her father that money was more important than life itself, and not only drove her professionally, because she is a tremendous professional success, but she says it also became my emotional priority. We become like the God whom we worship. In some sense, she idolized her father. She became like her father in idolizing money. Third point, and this story leads up to it. What will idols do to your children? Right? The Susie story is instrumental in this. What will idols do to your children? Let's look at Exodus 20, verse 5. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sins of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. It's very simple math. God says, if you do what's wrong, this sin is going to affect your family to the third or fourth generations. But if you do what is right, the blessings will come to 1,000th generation. Here's an example. Jonathan Edwards, who some regard as the greatest philosopher that America has ever produced, as well as being a great preacher, and at one time he was the president of Princeton University. They did a study of Jonathan Edwards, and of his descendants, this is what they found, that there were about 100 who became preachers and missionaries, 100 who became attorneys, 80 public officials, 75 Army and Navy officers, 65 college professors, 60 physicians, 60 prominent authors, 30 judges, 13 college presidents, 3 United States senators, and 1 vice president of the United States, all from one man. Another man of that era, a man named Max Jukes, was an alcoholic who couldn't hold a job, didn't care for his wife and children. And this is what the records show about Max Jukes, that 150 of his descendants were criminals. 100 were drunks, 7 were murderers, and more than half of the women that they could trace had become prostitutes. It affects our children. And some of you have young children, some of you don't have children yet. But who we worship today affects the generations to come. Whom we worship today, we become like the God who we worship. And that, in turn, affects those who come after us, even those who are not yet born. So, some questions for you this morning. Number one, what is the source of your security and worth? See, what's the source of your security and worth? Let me get that up. What makes you feel good about yourself? That's what the question's about. And we understand from the second commandment, well, we should feel good about God. But is there something else that holds our attention? What is it that our life revolves around? And if it's something that we can hold, something we can drive, something we can live in, something we can touch, something that won't survive the fires of the last judgment, then obviously we'll worship an idol. But another way to look at the question is this. what if you lost something, what would it be that would make your life collapse, right? What would cause your life to collapse? What possibly could you lose that would make your life collapse? And for some people, it might be a person. That if they lost this person, their life would collapse. If they lost their identity through their career, their life would collapse. Now, we know what the answer should be, which is if we lose God, our life would collapse. Is that really true? That if we lost God, all is lost. Nothing else could matter. So that's the first question. What's the source of your security and worth? Second question. What is the fruit of true worship in your life? If you're really worshiping God, where's the fruit to prove it? Where's the fruit to show it? If we become like the God whom we worship, then it means we need to become more godly. Right? We're becoming more godly if we become like the God whom we worship. Well, are we becoming more godly? Are we dealing with the same sins now that we've been dealing with for a long time? That's one way of looking at it. Are the sins that we're dealing with, that we're asking God to help us with, are they the same sins that we've been praying about for years and years and years? Are we really becoming more godly if we're dealing with the same issues? Thirdly, what's the fruit of true worship in your church? So let's take this from an individual application. Let's look at it from a church perspective. Because if, as individuals, you are worshiping God, then when you come together on Sundays as a church, you also would be worshiping God. And as a church, then, where is the fruit of true worship? Right? If we're really worshiping God together as a congregation, then where's the evidence of that? This is what Mike Iaconelli says. Do we actually believe that the world is impressed with our fancy new churches, 12,000 in Sunday school, 5 services each morning, the millions who are watching on television, converted beauty queens and professional athletes, our book sales, our crusades? The world is laughing at us, mocking us, and the Jesus we supposedly are serving. So he's saying, well, you know, what do we take pride in? In Christendom. We take pride in these huge churches that we built. We take pride in the beauty queen who's a Christian and gives her testimony in public. We take pride in the professional athlete who says, I'm a Christian. And we say, well, that's who we are. And he says, nah, the world, do you think they're really convinced by this? They're laughing at us because they aren't true indicators of worship. Another man writes this. Another pastor writes this. We are rich and increased with goods and have need of nothing. It is certainly true that not hardly anything is missing from our churches these days, except the most important thing. We're missing the genuine and sacred offering of ourselves and our worship to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. My own loyalties and responsibilities are and always will be with the strongly evangelical, Bible-believing, Christ-honoring churches. We've been surging forward. We're building great churches and large congregations. We're boasting about high standards, and we're talking a lot about revival. But I have a question, and it's not just rhetoric. What has happened to our worship? This follows along with what Iaconelli says, except this came from A.W. Tozer. If you're familiar with Tozer, the great writer of the Christian Missionary Alliance, and he wrote this about 50 years ago. An era when the churches are becoming larger and larger, when there's hardly anything that we need, but we're missing the most important thing. What has happened to our worship? Because if we're really worshiping God, when people walk in, they say, well, God is here because I sense God is here. A non-Christian will sense that God is here. A Christian will come in from another place and says, God's here. Maybe this is where I want to worship. Where's the fruit of worship as a congregation? Do people see Jesus when they look at us? That we reflect the God whom we worship. Do people see Jesus when they worship with us on Sundays? Because we've becoming like the God whom we worship. Shall we pray then?
Before I pray, if you can take about 30 seconds to again think upon this issue of idolatry. Are there idols in your life today? The temptations that are battling us with money, sex, power, or something else. Our Father, no one can stand before you and claim to be completely innocent of breaking this commandment. For all we all know that there are temptations that come into our lives and throughout our lives, temptations that beckon to us and call us away from following you. We also affirm our desire to be your followers, to be your disciples, to be like the God whom we worship, to be loving as you are, sacrificial and giving as you were on the cross, to give of ourselves to you and to the world. This also lies within us if we are called by your name. And so we ask for your continual power, grace, forgiveness, and help to be the people in the church you've called us to be. In Jesus' name, amen.